This is Going Up Alleys, a podcast, episode 6, Maps, Climate Change, and the Great Lakes. Welcome to another episode of Going Up Alleys. I'm your host, Stephen Sekula. This is another episode that's going to use some audio that I recorded quite some time ago with the intention of discussing it or playing it on the Mustang Physics podcast. But I got busy, that didn't happen. I didn't record any introductions or commentary for that, so this is actually going to be fairly fresh. What we're going to hear today is a very interdisciplinary talk by Professor Robert Markley. Dr. Markley is a professor of English, the W.D. and Sarah E. Trowbridge Professor of English, to be specific, at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And he came to SMU in the fall of 2011. It was an interdisciplinary seminar because while he's an English professor, he's interested in maps made by cartographers in the 1700s and 1800s. And what those maps can tell us, not about necessarily the accuracy of the map makers themselves, although that's something that can be studied in and of itself, but whether or not map makers represent a fine-grained picture of a region of the Earth as it goes through varying changes, for instance, induced by climate. So he's going to touch on many issues. He's going to touch on, first of all, the quality of cartography from that era, where the maps come from, getting that information into a digital format, and then doing something which is globally known as digital humanities, where you take computational algorithms and you marry those into questions of history and authorship and content and try to learn something across boundaries within disciplines. So maybe learn something about geology or climate, and not just about art and the art of map making, the science of cartography, and things like that. So without further ado, I'm going to turn things over to the person who actually hosted and introduced Dr. Markley for the seminar, and that's Professor Rajani Sudan, who's an associate professor of English at Southern Methodist University. She's going to give a brief introduction, and then Professor Markley is going to begin his seminar, which I can best summarize as being about maps and tying that to climate change with a specific focus on the Great Lakes.
I'd like to say that Bob Markley needs no introduction, but I can't, and that's actually a good thing, because I see several people in this room that probably have never met him or don't know a thing about him. So I'll go ahead and introduce him very briefly. Robert Markley is a W.D. and Sarah E. Trowbridge Professor of English at the University of Illinois. He is, along with Ron Schleifer, probably two people I know in my field that are really engaged in interdisciplinary work. And that is not merely attaching themselves to other disciplines in the humanities, but are reaching out to the sciences. And his work sort of reflects this in a kind of breathtaking way. I'll just mention a few of his books, although he's on, what, book number 6 at the moment, and article number 88. But anyway, his first kind of science-y book was called Fallen Languages, Crises of Representation in Newtonian England. And he has, along with, he's edited Virtual Realities and Their Discontents. He's the author of Dying Planet, Mars and Science and the Imagination. Most recently, The Far East and the English Imagination. And his work on climate. What's the title of your?
That's a good question, but it's on climate and culture during the Little Ice Age.
Okay, climate and culture during the Little Ice Age. And your work for the work you're presenting from today is taken from that book? Or?
Not really.
Not really. Okay. Never mind.
It's kind of a... I'll explain.
Okay. Well, I guess I will turn the floor over to Bob.
Thanks, Rajani, and thanks for inviting me. I'm going to turn the lights off in here so you can see the screen. This is going to be, I've been hanging out with computer scientists and climate scientists enough So I'm not reading a paper, I'm talking. Scientists get very nervous when English professors stand up there and read papers, as well they should. This is a presentation that came out of a joint NSF-NEH grant that I was a team member on with some of the people who you'll be meeting. This presentation is put together with Michael Simeone, who is the Associate Director for Institute for Computing and the Humanities, Arts, and Social Sciences at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. And so when we get to the regression analyses, I'm going to skip over those very quickly, and I can give you Michael's email. Or I could call him on the phone, one or the other. So this is a project, and I'll explain the genesis of the project and the nature of my collaboration, because I think it does something a bit different from what many people in the so-called digital humanities are doing, which are focusing on text-based data mining, which is interesting, I think that's fine, or on forms of social networking. I'm more interested in the people, the scientists I'm working with are all in the visualization lab at NCSA. We're more interested in what computers can do in terms of visual imaging and what they can tell us about resources that we have and what computers can do or supercomputing can do that we can't do with our own unaided vision. That's the pointer. Here we go. Okay, this grant we held for the better part of 2010 and 11, it was in the Digging into Data initiative. Our theme was the authorship-related questions, which I'll talk about a bit. The PI on it was Peter Bache, who has now left the University of Illinois for the National Institute for Standards and Measurement. And among all of the partners in it, we had $300,000, which is a lot less money than it actually sounds like. This Digging into Data program was a joint effort by the National Science Foundation, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joint Information Systems Committee in the UK, and the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. And one of the stipulations of the grant was you need to have team partners from at least three sites. We left out the Canadians this time around. So we actually had this multiple layer of dealing with collaborators. I'm sorry, there we go. University of Illinois, the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, which is located on the University of Illinois campus, researchers at Michigan State University, and researchers at the University of Sheffield. There were three parts to the grant. We were looking for common algorithms to do new kinds of high computing visual analysis. As you'll see, Michael and I were working on 17th century maps. The Michigan State people were working on a quilt project to identify authorship of quilts. And the University of Sheffield team was working with a colleague of mine in art history at the University of Illinois on medieval manuscripts. So we were looking for common ways of dealing with visual recognition. So these were the overall goals that we were funded for. We had to identify the salient characteristics of two-dimensional images of historical artifacts. So we were doing the 18th century maps. I'm sorry, this seems to have gone off the edge of the screen, which it's not supposed to. Discover the salient characteristics that distinguish artists or artistic traditions, and develop computational tools that can be applied across a range of data, which is what the NSF was interested in, and enable statistical learning vaguely defined about individual and collective authorship and develop new research questions and protocols to analyze larger data sets. So this was a proof of concept grant, basically. Whoops, let me go back. You can read about the overall collaboration in this article. First Monday is the journal published by the Digital Humanities Collective at MIT. And you can see the basic problem, these two brief quotations. There's so much data out there that it becomes impossible for us to evaluate it manually or simply by eyesight, and that organizing data becomes a paramount challenge. And that computational tools are not self-generated. You indeed have to write, I think this might be the wrong rough draft version of this, which I apologize for. But they required combined work of humanists and scientists with different disciplinary approaches to produce viable research methodologies and ways of teaching. So, we were given a set of parameters that are not ones that I necessarily would have chosen on my own. The authorship-related question was basically a way for us to get our feet in the front door to ask questions about maps in the 17th and 18th century. Why are these important? Well, you can see that there are, in a sense, four researchers working on this project. Peter Bache, the PI, has unfortunately left Illinois, and his GRA, Tenzing Shaw, is the one who actually developed the algorithms that will be that I'll be talking about today. But what you'll see is that we tried to find ways to come up with a computational means to compare what seemed to be fairly random versions of maps of the Great Lakes in the 17th and 18th century. Let me just say a little bit about 17th and 18th century maps. They're very pretty to look at. They're treated as artistic objects by art historians. They seem to hold, for many of us, limited cartographic information that we can be applied today. So when you look at these two widely different views of Lake Huron, and you will be talking about Manitoulin Island up here, which is here represented as a chain of islands. When we look at these maps, our initial reaction is, oh, that's beautiful. And our second reaction tends to be, oh, how wrong they got it. How funny it is. It doesn't look anything like Lake Huron. These folks had to be idiots, or they were just making stuff up without any data. And what I had found in my work dating back to my previous book on the Pacific Ocean was that mapping technologies seem to be very difficult. Excuse me. Tail end of a cough. Seem to be very difficult to categorize in terms of progress towards a more scientific understanding of various regions of the Earth. And so we weren't necessarily trying to distinguish between French and English artistic traditions, although that was the overall framework of the grant. What we were more interested in doing is finding out how cartography changed over time. And we need to remember that the Great Lakes were of vast strategic importance in the 18th century, particularly in the 1750s and 60s, when wars were fought between the French and the English. And what we are looking at when we're looking at Lake Huron are critically important trade routes, particularly for the fur trade in the 18th century. Now, I'd like you to look at some of the maps. I'm going to flip through some examples over this period. This is Lee's map from 1685. Now you can see this is not designed as a pretty picture to look at. This is crammed with, excuse me, all sorts of details. You'll notice that there are efforts to map in exaggerated fashion rivers that feed into the Great Lakes. There are efforts to identify forts, to identify mountainous regions, to identify fording places. So this map for somebody in 1685 has a great deal of use value rather than aesthetic value. Note particularly the shape of Lake Huron, which we'll come back to. This does not look like Lake Huron does on maps today. Hennepin's map, French map, from 1701. Now, you'll notice that there are significant differences between the British map and the French map. These are not artistic. You can see that Hennepin and his collaborators are making, you know, a good faith effort to get as much information, including the various tribes in the region, onto one map. There are characteristics which we'll look at of exaggerated connections between lakes, kind of mystical islands in the middle of Lake Michigan, on Lake Superior, that are intending to convey information for traders, for explorers, for fur trappers. Let's look at a slightly later map. This is the fabled French and Indian War map of 1759. And again, this is actually seems to be French-Canadian. We're not sure of that. You can see there are efforts there to distinguish, you know, a political boundary between British and French territory. You'll notice that the lake shapes begin to resemble something that's closer to what we would think of as Lake Michigan today. But again, there's this bizarre map of Lake Huron, which we'll come back to. And you'll notice this elongated and enlarged waterway to Lake Erie. Lake Erie is too long and thin, and Ontario is too squat. Now, again, this was a map that was produced during the conflicts between the British and French. It is a strategic map, clearly concerned with indigenous allies of the French, and also with mapping accurately where these tribes are. And the Crow Indians there, and waterways by which you can communicate with the interior. Carey's map in 1806. Now, here's the basic problem that we confront with this project. This map, in many ways, looks less accurate, in scare quotes, than the maps we just looked at. Look, for example, at how elongated Lake Michigan becomes here. Look, for example, at the weird shape of Lake Huron. And what I'll be talking about later is notice that Manitoulin Island has been broken up into a chain of islands. 1806. Steamboats. 1806. The United States is a country. It's not just a random collection of colonies. And so if we wanted to plot a progressive history of map making, we would think that something like this, with its obvious inaccuracy from our 21st century perspective, would be an outlier, that there would be something wrong, that whoever drew this map was incompetent. And that's the question that we were investigating. Now, we quickly recognize, and because I work on climate change, that the differences in shapes of lakes and the differences in depictions of islands may well be reflecting actual material conditions on the ground and actual ambiguities that we forget about in terms of cartography. This is the water depth in meters in the Great Lakes today. This is Manitoulin Island that we'll look at here. And you can see that this passage in the northern lobe of Lake Huron, which was an extremely important trade route, is very shallow, less than 20 meters in depth. Historically, we know that the level of the Great Lakes have varied over time. If you work in historical climatology, you will quickly realize that although there's a kind of boilerplate benchmark of middle of the 19th century for instrumentation measurements of temperature and so on, that in reality, measurements well into the latter half of the 19th century are not really trustworthy. So that means when we're talking about climate change over, say, the last 300 or 500 or 1,000 years, we actually have to rely on what scientists call proxy data, tree rings, coral growth, sediments and bogs, to determine what climatological conditions are at any given place. And indeed, there are groups of scientists working on bogs in Canada. However, what those kinds of studies indicate tend to be general patterns over fairly wide areas. And so what we lack often in the historical record is an understanding of what a 1 foot or 2 foot or 3 foot variation in lake levels in the Great Lake region means. We are working with climatologists at the University of Illinois in the School of Earth Science and Environment who are actually interested in this demonstration project, because it turns out that when you run simulations today, the level of water in the Great Lakes has enormous consequences for the climate of the Midwestern part of the country. And that if you vary lake levels, or vary levels in lakes, you can produce fairly wide ranges going out 30 and 40 years in what the climate of the Midwest will look like, which concerns us all, even if we don't live in Illinois, because of growing seasons, drought, flooding, all sorts of problems that we associate with climate change. So the initial objectives in the grant proposal were to figure out some way to compare all those maps we just looked at. The question that I wanted to ask about climatology is not something that I can simply go to a computer scientist and say, okay, you do this for me. We had to figure out a way that we could get some kind of computational specificity out of the 40 maps in our original data set. Okay. What we decided on that was computationally doable was to create a means to determine the surface area of irregular shapes of the Great Lakes on maps. So, while we might not be able to compare Lake Huron in this map to Lake Huron in that map, and, you know, in great detail, what we could do is calculate the square mileage of this. Then we wanted to use the newly generated data to determine how much knowledge sharing there existed between French and British cartographers, and ascertain if there was any unique knowledge specific to regions of the lakes that were encoded in national cartographic traditions. So this is how we were fitting in to this authorship question, British traditions versus French traditions. Okay, reasonably interesting. These are the forms of knowledge that the maps basically encode. Okay? Accounts, sketches, map makers are, of course, are interested in producing accurate maps to integrate multiple sources. As we'll see, there's scale bars, which help to locate precisely accurate geospatial representation. But this was our you know, key kind of working hypothesis. If climatological conditions shift over time, they can produce seemingly erratic representations of coastlines and islands. So, we had to consider all sorts of scientific and technological considerations, okay? You can see these here. There was no formal survey of the Great Lake region until 1820. So before then, we're relying on hand sketches, accounts, and rather primitive instrumentation. There were no chronometers taken into the Great Lakes, as far as we can tell, at any point in the 18th century, although they were used to determine longitude at sea. So, with some exceptions, cartographic representations improve over time. You can kind of get a sense looking at Lake Erie from here, to Cary, to Arrowsmith in 1817, just before steamship travel becomes commonplace on the lakes, and there's a satellite image from 2004. As our second point indicates, you'll notice that the waterways between lakes are exaggerated. And the reason for that seems to be these are optimistic renditions of how easy it is to get from the lake to the next lake, okay, trade routes. So when you look at these, you know, look at these waterways on the map, and you can compare it today, well, the waterway may conceivably have been wider then, you can see that this is creating, as the 1685 map does, the image of a much wider channel, a 10, 12-mile wide channel that can easily get you further up into the Great Lakes and facilitate trade and colonization. Here we can see what these waterways look like in detail. And you'll notice that considering what they had to work with, these are not bad, you know, renditions. You basically had to sail around the edge of the lake, or you had to walk around the edge of the lake. And so you're doing this in a kind of very hands-on sort of way. Even in Lake Erie, which is relatively accurately drawn, you can see that in the 18th century, there's a group of three islands that are figured in this kind of protruding bay in the southwest corner of the lake, which you don't see on the map today. But what the satellite image does show, as you can tell, are very shallow water areas. And if lake levels are varying, and they can vary for a number of reasons, this map may not be a figment of some cartographer or explorer's imagination. We may actually have been looking at a different sort of geographical and hydrological situation in the 18th century. Now, how did we set about doing this? Okay, this is why you need to collaborate if you're a humanist with scientists, right? I do not get paid to computer code, right? It's not worth the university's money for me to learn how to, well, and can do a little bit of coding, but it's not worth it for me to sit down and try to reproduce that labor as part of my research project. So what we developed, or what Tenzing Shaw, the graduate student working on this, developed, was what's called a segmentation algorithms and a workflow. So workflow simply means algorithms acting in succession. First, we had to isolate the shape of each lake in order to determine lakes from land masses. We had to teach the computer to do that. Secondly, teach the software to do that. Then determine the scale of each map by the neat lines and determine a ratio of pixel degrees of latitude. And then come up with an algorithm that would count the pixels within identified shapes and then calculate the surface area. So really what I refer to this as is the bouncing ball algorithm, which it will demonstrate, okay? First of all, you have to teach the, you have to teach a computer to recognize that this is a border between land and water, but so is this, and so are these, which turns out to be hard to do. And the algorithm that Tenzing developed basically sent this kind of bouncing ball hundreds of thousands of times within the outlines of the lake to create an accurate measurement of the surface area of the lake. We're not, one of the things that we have to do in the next stage is figure out what happened in a situation like this. Theoretically, we actually are distinguishing land from water there, but as you can see, it's hard to do. You also have to teach the algorithm that this is not a land mass, that this is writing, and that this is writing. So it was a complicated process, which you can't do. This is why you need a supercomputer, okay? This is why you need high-performance computing. There's no way to calculate this. You get your ruler and protractor out, you know, you will be in, you know, in a padded cell in very short order. This is what's called a neat line at the bottom of the map, okay? And it's a scale of degrees of latitude. This is Mackenzie from 1801. And what this allows a computer to do is convert pixels to degrees of latitude, to fractions of degrees of latitude, which gives you a measure so that you can count the pixels within the cutout shape of Lake Erie or Lake Michigan. Right? So we needed this. But then you have to teach the computer to distinguish, you know, what this mark signifies, what that mark signifies, what the scale is, and so on. So that was the second stage in the workflow. What this would allow us to produce is a cutout or mask. Whoops. Sorry. A cutout or mask of the lake, which then could be measured. The next stage that we couldn't accomplish is not only to increase the data set to far more maps, but to be able to segment off parts of lakes so that we can, you know, draw an artificial line here and then just have the program calculate the square area in there.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So that image results from applying the computer algorithm workflow to that map?
Right.
So those little places where it looks like they're peninsulas, is that where the computer still can't distinguish between handwriting? Okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
Well, it's yes. This is, you know,
right.
Yeah, it's very, you know, you can see that here's where your problem is.
Yeah.
I think that this is a relatively low quality resolution blown up version of this image. The map is much smaller. And this is actually more accurate than you would think looking at this map.
Okay.
At least that's what we decided. I mean, there are limitations to what the algorithm could do and not do. Because technically, what you have to do is create sort of as I call it, bouncing ball, something that won't, like, go up these rivers, you know, something that's bigger than the pixels that it's counting. Mm-hmm. So that seemed to be a problem solved. I'm not going to, this is the regression analysis, and basically what it shows, you can see the British maps are in blue, you can see the French are in red. I think that what the regression analysis shows is that there's a clustering of measurements of the square mileage of the lake, which cluster in this triangle here, or this rectangle here over time. This is the actual square mileage of the lake as we understand it today. But we're in a kind of Benoit Mandelbrot, how long is the coast of England problem. This is what we get from satellite data today. So one of the things that you can see is that the bizarre outliers in all of these mapping traditions, and although the maps generally get more accurate over time, there are still maps into the 19th century which are wildly inaccurate, even though there are other accurate maps being drawn at the same time. Lake Erie, for some reason, the French consistently treated Lake Erie as though it was a river. These long, narrow shapes of Lake Erie. The British tended to be much more accurate. The two I wanted to call your attention to is where there's less accuracy over time, Lake Superior. The British tended to be more accurate than the French. This is probably some Frenchman thinking he's found the Northwest Passage. I mean, again, you look at the square mileage of the lake and you can see they're off by orders of magnitude. But the really interesting one is Lake Huron, in terms of just square mileage, because you can see that there's not, with this, particularly these maps down here, all clustering after 1800 demonstrate, that there's not a vast improvement in terms of determining the size of Lake Huron, which the British and French traveled through continually. So, how can we account for that? We can go back one. Well, the horizontal patterns indicate moments where we suspect knowledge is shared from one cartographer to the next. That is, if you're doing a map here, you may have the French map or the English map there. Okay. There are linear improvements in the mapping for some regions that we just showed, like Ontario, but not for others. And there's no meta-argument to explain the variations in the representation of Lake Superior and Huron. It's not that they were less explored. It's not that there were fewer people traipsing through them. It's not that there were, you know, fewer tribes they were, you know, engaged with. So these were our kind of initial hypotheses being modified in terms of what we determined there. Sorry. Okay. Climatological variables and cartography. There's a socio-political thesis that could come out of the mapping. And I think this is what many historians who we talked to, or at least some of the historians, wanted to go for. Unstable political control of the region, the so-called French and Indian Wars, 1757 to 63, different trading routes, changing relationships with various tribes, differential knowledges of the lakes. So that, in a sense, you know, you could, for example, be cut off from access to an area of a lake for 10 or 15, 20 years if you were a British explorer or cartographer, and therefore you wouldn't have accurate information. But wait. We're not going to get NSF to give us more money for that. The climatological thesis that ice cover, changing lake levels, and the difficulties of distinguishing between ice and land, water and wetlands and so-called salt land contribute to the extreme surface inconsistencies of Lake Huron and Superior, despite technological improvements in instrumentations over the course of the 18th century. Okay. We've begun to look at accounts of explorers and traders from the 18th into the 19th century, 1816. Okay? On June 2nd, I left Lake Huron, still covered with ice, for several miles from shore. Now, the region we're going to be talking about, as I said, is Manitoulin Island. This is 1816. Now, you know, this is all right. You know, this is cold, right? It's colder than Texas up here, but you do not find ice covering any of the Great Lakes in June. Now, we need to remember that during this period, we're still in the so-called Little Ice Age, which, at least in North America, the eastern half of North America, and in Europe, temperatures were, on average, about a centigrade degree cooler than they are in the period 1920 to 1960. And so one of the things that we're hypothesizing is that the normative conditions of the lakes in the Little Ice Age were much more like what we would consider terrible winters today when ice covers the lake. There are also obvious other factors involved, such as damming up of streams, pollutants which tend to be warmer flowing into the lakes. After all, I live near Chicago. But you can see that you could not leave. This is, by the way, whoops, I'm sorry about that. Keep hitting the wrong button. If you can see this arrow over here, this is where Wingfield is writing from. This is where he's leaving the northern lobe of the lake. This is still an ice-covered area for several miles from shore. This is an ice cover map in northern Huron from a very harsh winter in 1989. This is for April 10th. Now, this is the percentage of ice cover. And you can see the darker areas mean more ice coverage. So you can see that the northern regions of Huron here are 95-96% covered with ice in April of 1989. And you can see that there were significant ice that actually disrupted shipping on Superior during this same time. And you can see that there are parts of Lake Huron which are effectively iced in. Now, I think that this is, you know, this is critical. I mean, if we're down here in Chicago, you know, we're looking out on Lake Michigan. You know, it looks like Michigan normally does. But as you go north, you have a situation, particularly around Manitoulin Island. There are people actually walking from Canada to Manitoulin Island, apparently, during this harsh winter. Remember, we've only had satellite Landsat coverage of our climate for a relatively short period of time, a blip of the eye in climatological terms, and even in historical terms. When I was born, there were no satellite images of the Earth. So this gives us some sense of what the conditions may have been like for somebody trying to map the region in the early 19th century. This is ice cover from a NASA satellite of Manitoulin Island, which you can, you know, barely see here. You'll notice that the northern lobe of Lake Huron is practically covered with ice, and you can see the ice along the coasts there. So, if you're in a canoe, if you're, and you've got a very short trading season to get to Lake Superior and trade for furs there, you don't have time to sit around and drill ice cores. You don't have time to, you know, engage in lengthy discussion with other traders or with members of various indigenous tribes about what weather conditions are like. So that you can see, even in the 21st century, you can get significant ice cover, which is going to have knock-on effects in terms of how you represent the region. Now, let's look at these maps again. Satellite image here, 2004, ice cover. Well, look at what happens, three maps within a 20-year period. Manitoulin Island is drawn by Carey reasonably accurately as a single island. Now, as you can see, this image is a little dark, Manitoulin Island is cut by all sorts of bays and waterways in through these regions. This is very low-lying land, fertile but low-lying land. Look at Russell in 1801. Manitoulin Island has deconstructed itself into a chain of islands. And Arrowsmith in 1814, same thing. Not a single island as we see here, cut by bays and inlets, but a chain of islands. Well, what's our explanation for this? Well, one explanation is good cartography versus bad cartography, right? That's always possible. One is good information versus bad information. But it doesn't take a great deal of stretch of the imagination to think that one of several things is happening here. Are we looking at wetlands here, which are being described as solid land or visualized as solid land, at a time when the lake levels may have been comparatively cooler? Okay? That is, cooler lake levels, more ice freezes out, more dry land is exposed. Whereas here, if this is being drawn from data in the summer of 1800 or 1799, warm weather could cause flooding along here. Same thing here. We don't seem to have wetlands anymore in the United States, very much, but it's a significant problem. How do you map a swamp? Is a swamp that you can wade through solid land, or is it water? If you're in, if you're in hip boots fly fishing in the spring, do you know that you're standing in water, or do you think that you're standing on what will appear to be solid land at some other point of the season? So this is our best guess assumption about what may be going on, because otherwise you've got, you know, just kind of random variations, both in the size of the lake and the shape of the lake, which are very hard to account for. Because these are all reputable cartographers. Aerosmith is in all English geography books in the early 19th century. So I believe, if I remember correctly, Jane Austen's family had a copy of Aerosmith's geographies. So this is what, you know, Jane Austen is sitting down to look at while she's writing Persuasion. That's the map of Lake Huron. What's really interesting is that over time, there doesn't seem to be any improvement. In terms of quote-unquote modern mapping and accuracy, the size of Lake Huron is quote-unquote inaccurate here, but Manitoulin Island looks very much like what we would recognize as Manitoulin Island today. Morse, 1822, there's steamships beginning to show up on the Great Lakes by 1822. Manitoulin Island has disappeared into this chain of islands, although the shape of Lake Huron is, in terms of square mileage and also just our intuitive sense of what the lake looks like, is more accurately drawn than here. But yet you have this otherwise very difficult to account for disintegration of Manitoulin Island into this chain of islands.
Just a quick question, because I'm having a little trouble with the scale here. How much do you need to raise the lake level to break it up, the island, into a series of chains?
That is a great question, and there's not a good answer for that, because the data on lake levels prior to the mid-19th century is pretty poor. We can see six to 7 feet changes in lake levels historically.
Okay.
Is just in records going back 200 years.
But if you've got DEM models of the island itself, you should know the topography of it.
Right.
And so what are the low spots that if you raise the lake level 1 foot would become creeks running through it?
If we look at this here, a lot of what seems to be solid coastline are actually wetlands, or still wetlands. So that's the problem. I mean, there is a subjective element to this. It's very possible to be standing on solid ground, looking out at a wetlands, looking out at, you know, acres of lily pads, for example, and rendering that in different kinds of ways. Now, when we originally started doing this, I wanted to work with maps of China, because Chinese cartographers are generally better through the mid-19th century than their Western counterparts. And they actually have symbols for salt marshes, for freshwater marshes, and for other kinds of, and for canals, for non-natural waterways. So if you look at 17th and 18th century maps of China, you'll see large areas, the Pearl River Delta, which are drawn as marsh, which in a sense means oftentimes they're navigable by boat at certain times of the year, but not at others. So part of the problem here is Manitoulin Island also is all farms. And topsoil has been dragged in large areas. So it's hard to tell what the island, quote-unquote, looked like. We've gone back to look at 19th century accounts and journals. We have, for example, Wingfield's account. There are other French explorers' accounts, which tell us a little bit about this. But, you know, if you talk to any farmer, because we do this, the Agricultural Survey of Illinois does this fairly frequently. You know, they'll remember what they did to the land, but they'll have no idea often if their grandfather or their father or the previous owner dredged a pond, for example, or deepened a pond, or if the pond's even artificial or not. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you. And actually, while we're on scale, can I ask you one more?
Sure.
Quick?
Yeah.
Back up one.
Okay.
How rapidly are lake levels changing? And can you get a change from 1796 to the summer of 1799 of enough vertical throw of your lake that you can turn an island into a series of little tiny islands?
That's a great question. And the problem is complicated by this, ice. And the problem is if a wetlands ice is over, which we're unused to, I mean, obviously it's not going to happen in Texas, right? If this there's a question of how far you can walk out on the ice and how solid the ice is. There were only 3 months to get to Lake Superior and trade and get back. You had 3 months. And in the age before steamships, this was really, really tough. Once you had steamships, Margaret Fuller goes on a tour of the Great Lakes in the 1840s, and, you know, it's very easy to do. Prior to that, people are racing. You know, my guess is that, and you can see that there are actually good faith efforts here to indicate water depths. You can see the shaded area there, which is a map convention.
I brought the wrong glasses. I can't
okay.
see anything.
Okay. Well, okay.
I'll take your word for it, though.
Yeah, you see that okay. blurry part next to the blurry part? Yeah.
You're right. That blurry part next to the blurry part. You know, we were talking to Don Wobbles, who heads our climate, our Center for Climate Change at Illinois, and he said, you know, nobody has ever asked this question before, is how much of a lake level rise would you need? And then, you know, we know that in the 19th century, there was a fair amount of dredging that went on. So that some of these kind of weird little islands that don't really seem to exist today may have been sandbars. Who's using the map? People walking along the shore or people who are actually on the water. And the Great Lakes are very treacherous waters to navigate. So there's another question, or is this, you know, are these chains of islands here islands, or you can see it better here, are these islands, are they sandbars?
They're islands.
You know.
Granite. They're granite, yeah. Because the difference between the North Shore of Georgian Bay
right.
is in the Canadian Shield.
Right.
And Manitoulin is like the Bruce Peninsula in Michigan. It's
right.
It's south. And so it's softer. But, I mean, I've spent 50 years on Lake Huron.
Yeah.
And I've seen the water levels change. I mean, it's
how
four
much?
Feet lower now than
right.
it was 35 years
okay.
ago. And I've seen islands.
4 feet.
I've seen islands that, like a single island, there's one very close to where I go, that's essentially one island joined by a kind of an isthmus that's
yeah.
about 4 feet out of the water these days. And, you know, most of the time when I was a kid, on the maps, it was one island.
Right.
But it was two islands in reality, and you could canoe
with
right over.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've seen plenty of islands that, for years, I mean, they didn't exist, and now there are islands there. They're definitely there.
I think you're hired, Chris, as a consultant.
Even in the, until radar, navigating to go from, say, Collingwood in the southern part of, on the other side of the Bruce Peninsula, down in there, up the Georgian Bay coast towards the French River, beyond, if
yeah.
you were going up in those channels
yeah.
To Lake Superior, it was incredibly treacherous.
Yes.
Because
yeah.
It's called the 30,000 islands, but there's actually millions of
yeah.
islands, and that's not counting the islands that in certain seasons
right.
are, I mean, it's
right.
granite, and it's
right.
just a foot or two below water.
Right. I mean, one of the, when I gave a presentation of this in Maine, and they said that there were analogous problems with charting the Maine coast.
It's very much like the
you
Maine
know.
Coast. It's very much like Finland.
Yeah. Too. So that you can't really, you know, you can look at maps of Maine that look identical, but they're actually, the number of islands will vary from 100 to 10,000 over a period of like 30 years in terms of mapping because it's sea levels. So the water levels, I think, you know, we can say that the change in water levels in the Great Lakes seems to be, you know, man-made these days. But also of reflecting temperatures, but, you know, 1801, could this be a warm spring with flood water? Sure, versus this, you know?
Just have one question
sure.
related to the water level and ice. Geography and climatology are my Achilles heels, so maybe my question will end that. But I'm wondering if you've got this algorithm that can calculate the surface area of these lakes as they're
yeah.
represented in the maps,
yeah.
would there be any benefit to doing something like an analysis of variance to compare the size of the island in each map to the overall size of the lake to
we
see
could.
How that's
yeah.
related.
We were, exactly. I mean, one of the things that we could do is precisely that. I mean, originally, I was thinking of an algorithm that would measure the coastlines of islands. And what we ran into was a critical problem, is that relatively few maps are digitized, and that we decided that we couldn't afford on the grant to pay for maps. So we went with maps that the University of Illinois had that had already been digitized. Illinois, Great Lakes. So that was part of our decision making. We now have access to a private map collection, the David Rumsey collection. If you've never seen this, you should check it out online.
Okay.
It's absolutely amazing. This guy is a real estate billionaire and buys maps the way that, normal human beings might buy tennis balls or something. One gets a little flat. He has thousands of maps online. So our next stage of the project, to get a larger data set, we will be able to do, those sorts of things. Computer time is not cheap. No.
All right, I'm going to end it there. It's already been almost an hour of seminar, and just to give you a sense of how dynamic this presentation was, the discussion about the methods that Dr. Markley used, the conclusions that he was able to draw, knowledge of the local geography and geology, went on for another hour, and nobody was bored. It was extremely lively. You have people from the humanities, the sciences, all interacting and engaging on this. I was in the audience. I'm a physicist, and I was fascinated by this. What I liked about this subject is that you have a simple, seemingly simple question. What was going on in the climate before humans had instrumentation to do fine-grained measurements? And you have resources that you can use to attempt to answer this. But people kept records of what they perceived the land to look like as they were engaging in fur trading missions or mapping out strategic territories. For use in, for instance, wars between the British and the French in North America. This is really an incredible and dynamic topic, and it's obviously not at all simple to attack this question, but what I found personally very interesting about the work that Dr. Markley and his colleagues have done is that they've taken their different perspectives on scholarship, and they've combined those together to try to answer a question that cuts across the boundaries of their scholarships. And I find that personally very fascinating. And I hope that you sort of take this as an opportunity to think more deeply about the kinds of questions that you're encountering day to day and how you as a thinker or a scientist might dig into that topic by reaching across the hall to a different department to get somebody else's perspective, get somebody else's tools and talents, and collaborate with them to try to attack hard problems that are of great import to the world. I mean, there's nothing now more important than understanding the effects of climate on land, on people, on migratory patterns, on the functioning of cities and civilization. And we have lots of periods in our history where climate has shifted, if only briefly, and we can learn something from the fact that that's happened in the past and try to think about what implications exist for the future. And so whether it's the physics or the chemistry, the biology, the sociology, the geology, the geography, or even in this case, the art of cartography that's affected by that, I find this to be a very interesting question. And no doubt there are millions of other such interesting questions that can only be approached this way. So I hope you've taken this as a way to get yourself kind of engaged or hooked into the idea of interdisciplinarity, and that you can carry that forward into something you do in your lifetime that may be of interest to a wide range of people. Well, that's it for this episode of Going Up Alleys. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have, and I look forward to seeing you next time on the podcast. This has been Going Up Alleys, a podcast by Stephen Sekula. Music was provided by Nikoko. The song is Occipital from the album Classic Hoko, available for download on Jamendo.